Welcome to the Science Podcast for November 25th, 2011. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. This week, electricity and the road to greenhouse gas reductions, mysteries of the cell, and a proof of concept for neural circuitry repair.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. A common rallying cry among advocates for reduced greenhouse gas emissions is 80 and 50. That is, that emissions should be cut 80% from 1990 levels by the year 2050 to stave off dangerous climate change. Setting such a target is easy, of course, but figuring out how to meet it is something else. Now, a group of energy and economics researchers has analyzed what would need to happen to meet this goal in one specific advanced economy, the state of California. They conclude that a rapid transition to an energy economy dominated by decarbonized electricity and the electrification of direct fuel uses is essential to achieving the 80 and 50 goal. Snoola Price, an author on the study, spoke with me about it from his office in San Francisco.
We have developed a rigorous approach for analyzing what's physically necessary to prevent catastrophic climate change. And then we took that methodology and applied it to California, looking in detail at what would be necessary to meet the CO2 emissions goal of 80% below 1990 levels.
And that's by 2050.
By 2050. And I think what's interesting for some of your readers will be the methodology, looking at the approach and applying it to their country or economy. And I think for others, it will be the findings based on the work that we did in California.
Right. So there have been, you know, quite a lot of reports and forecasts about our future energy outlook, you know, from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the Department of Energy and such. What makes yours different? What's new in this paper?
Well, I think one of the key things to reference is the Pakala and Sokolow paper in Science in 2004, which really showed that it's possible to achieve deep greenhouse gas emission reductions. What our paper does differently is we provide a detailed infrastructure model approach that can look at the different linkages in infrastructure, our economy, our homes, buildings. So for us, the wedges are really an output of our model, not an input, and it allows us to ask additional questions about how to achieve the pathway of GHG reductions.
And so it's actually looking at what's technologically feasible rather than just sort of the ideal scenarios?
That's right. That's right. We have a stock rollover model embedded in our methodology that looks at, for example, how many homes do we have in California economy, how many cars, businesses, power plants that all age and can get replaced and renewed. So we and all the linkages between them, so energy use linked to the electricity grid. We have a model of how the grid would actually operate to be able to provide reliable, you know, electricity service and that type of thing.
Okay, well then, you know, let's get right down to it. Ultimately, what are the biggest changes, the most important changes that are going to have to take place to meet these greenhouse gas standards?
So there are three primary things that we need to do. We need to do first a unprecedented level of energy efficiency, something on the order that California achieved during the energy crisis, but sustained over the 40-year period. Then secondly, we need almost complete decarbonization of our electric generation, so no fossil fuels combusted and released into the atmosphere from electric generation. And then thirdly, we need to electrify nearly all fossil fuel end uses, thinking of the transportation sector primarily, but also other appliances, other uses of fossil fuels. The order in doing this is really important. For example, the amount of decarbonized generation you need is really impacted by, you know, how much energy efficiency you've been able to achieve. The other linkage that's really important is that if you haven't decarbonized electric generation before you start to electrify, then you're still going to have significant CO2 emissions.
So they all play off of one another.
They all play off each other, and you know, we've really tried to capture all of those interdependencies.
So this last point that you brought up is sort of one of the big ones that the paper emphasizes, you know, electrifying transportation and all these sort of fossil fuel end uses. So what, you know, what technologies would come in and do that?
Yeah, absolutely. The only pathway we found that can meet the goal is through a massive amount of electrification. Electricity use in our modeling and all our scenarios that actually achieve the goal, electricity use must double. And that's even after all of the energy efficiency. The new technologies that we need are in the end uses. So we really need batteries that are, you know, incrementally improved from those that we have now that are more energy dense and less expensive so that we can have electric vehicles. We also need to, very critically important, figure out how to do smart charging of those vehicles so that they can be a resource on our electricity grid. And I think the other thing that's important to mention is that our study is about greenhouse gas emissions, but there are also other significant implications for having an electricity-driven energy economy, and they're exciting. There would be a dramatic improvement in local air quality, and also energy security, because we would be using domestic energy and not relying on oil imports.
And then as for another one of your major changes is, you know, as you said, decarbonizing electricity. I was surprised to notice that actually still could include natural gas. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, there are three main ways to generate electricity without releasing more CO2 into the atmosphere: renewable energy, nuclear power, and carbon capture and sequestration. And so I think one of the pathways that you're referring to, California could still use natural gas, but sequester the CO2 so that it's not released into the atmosphere. As we build more of each of these technologies, renewables, nukes, and CCS, or some combination or one or the other, we're somewhat agnostic to what the mix is. The interesting thing is that the cost of each of those technologies converges. So the big differentiating factor isn't cost. And the big differentiating factor between them isn't the amount of electricity we could generate with either or any one of those. The differentiating factors, of course, are the non-GHG environmental costs. Think nuclear waste disposal for nuclear, land use for renewables, water use for CCS, and also commercialization of CCS. And then the other differentiating factor is the electricity grid operability. How do we keep the lights on reliably with large amounts of intermittent resources?
So you've clearly taken into account really a whole lot of variables here throughout the life cycle of each one of these technologies. And so, you know, you also mentioned biofuels and biomass and urban planning and, you know, working on the infrastructure and deployment of all of these things. So what do you think are going to be the biggest challenges in realizing this scenario?
So if we continue to innovate and invest in R&D, I think that the technology development required is plausible to meet the goal. But California cannot achieve an 80% reduction on its own. California is not an island. And even if it could, reducing or even eliminating California emissions cannot solve the global problem. So there's two really big challenges, which are sustainability over the 40-year time horizon and scale. And those are ultimately political, I think. In terms of sustainability, the solution is really an infrastructure problem. And how are we going to continue an investment over 40 years through all the governments that California will have? And then, you know, as I said, California is not an island. So other states, the nation, and the world are also going to have to be investing in low carbon pathways. And then in terms of scale, it's really just massive. Even after the amount of energy efficiency that we're talking about, California would still need to build 1.5 to 2 new nuclear plants every year through 2050. To put it in perspective, California only has 2 nuclear plants. So
wow.
It's really an incredible amount of scale and an infrastructure project and infrastructure development. Now, the wild card in all of this is really behavior and behavior change. You mentioned we factored in a lot of different things, including biofuel pathways, urban planning. One of the things that we're very conservative on is people's behavior and their energy use. So, for example, if people were to bicycle more, or walk more, vegetarianism, consumption of fewer goods, those types of things would significantly reduce the scale of the infrastructure requirements. The one area that we did include in our study was smart growth, basically putting homes closer to businesses, closer to schools. And that's something that California is focused on trying to encourage currently, but we were not very bullish on that in our study, and purpose, we're quite conservative.
So this is all centered around these goals that have to be implemented by 2050. So, you know, right now in the year 2011, almost 2012, what do we have to do right now?
So the most important thing that we have to do right now, and it is quite urgent, is continuing to invest in research and development. If you think about the scale of the amount of new electric generation we need, it's truly massive, and this is the decade to really improve the technology and get the cost down to a level where we can really keep it on a sustainable long-term path. So getting the cost down of renewable energy, figuring out how we can do energy efficiency and retrofits more cost-effectively. Basically, we have to get the learning done so that the prices are reasonable before we have to buy in bulk.
Okay, well, Snu the Price, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Snu the Price is an author on a new study on the technology path to deep cuts in greenhouse gas emissions. You can find the paper at www.scienceexpress.org.
Next week, thousands of scientists will descend on Denver, Colorado, for the annual meeting of the American Society for Cell Biology. That incipient event has prompted science's news and editorial staffs to ponder the many things we still don't understand about the cell and its inner workings. Five of those enduring mysteries of the cell are highlighted in a news-focused package this week. I spoke with Science Deputy News Editor John Travis about the package. So, John, in this package, there's a quote from a cell biologist, Günter Blobel, in which he says that the number of things we don't know about the cell is, quote-unquote, staggering. How did you guys settle on the five mysteries that you highlight here?
I actually think that was probably the most difficult part of the whole project. Writing the stories was the easy part in the end. Basically, we polled a lot of biologists. We've done this in the past at Science for the 125th anniversary. We looked at big questions in science. And for this project, we wanted to go into a specific discipline. And Bruce Alberts, the editor-in-chief, is a cell biologist, so that seemed to be a natural place to start. And he and a bunch of his colleagues are also co-authors of one of the best-known textbooks in the field. So he started by talking with them about what was unknown in the field. And then we expanded it to some of our board of reviewing editors and a few outside biologists. And we got more than enough mysteries and questions to keep us busy. Unfortunately, we didn't get a consensus as to what the top three or four were. So we had to pick a few that seemed to show up consistently and then pick a few that were maybe a bit more obscure, but we liked.
Well, let's look at some of the ones you picked. One of them is this notion of how cells know when they've reached the right size, I guess, which is important in a variety of diseases.
Well, we think it might be. We're not really sure because we don't understand too much about how a cell determines its own size. We know that cells come in a variety of sizes. Take a look at a sperm cell and an egg cell, and there's a vast difference in size. Neurons grow, I think the number is maybe a meter, or at least project axons that long. And so when does a cell stop growing, and when does it know if it's big enough to divide?
Well, what are some of the hypotheses on that?
Well, people are trying to find what they consider a sizer, a measuring tool that the cell uses. And a couple of the ideas are that there's a chemical that perhaps the concentration gets lower and lower as the cell gets bigger. And once it's low enough, it triggers a circuit that tells the cell, hey, I'm big enough, I can divide now. There are also filaments in the cell that extend, microtubules and so forth. And if you know that something extends across a cell at a particular rate, you can kind of work backwards and get to what the size of the cell is. And so people are trying to identify some of the genes involved. And there are also some subtleties about how quickly cells grow, whether they're linear or exponential, mm-hmm. that determines whether or not cells actually do know their size. Some people don't think they do.
Well, this may sound like an easy question for a non-cell biologist to pose, but of the problems that you highlighted, this seemed like one that I was a little surprised hadn't been solved by now. What makes this so difficult to solve?
Well, that's actually a good question, and I think part of it is cell biologists study cells en masse in big groups, and so really studies of individual cells, which I think ultimately may need to do to solve this question, is we're only getting the tools now where we can do a lot of precision measurements. And so I think this was simply one that people didn't experimentally address for a long time. And you mentioned whether it had relevance to diseases. I don't think it's totally clear that it does, so you don't have the biomedical motivation. We do know that in certain cancers, cells are either bigger or smaller, but you don't know if that's important.
Right. Mechanistically, whether it has any relevance.
So I think it's a question for the next decade, but it wasn't a huge one in the past.
So turning to another one, the story cites this whole notion of protein localization, how a cell gets all of its proteins in the right places, if you will, as a big outstanding mystery. What does protein localization actually mean?
Well, this was a question that I think a lot of the people we polled referred to in different fashions. But if you think about a cell, a human cell may make up to 10,000 proteins, I think one of the more recent analyses shows. And those proteins have to go to specific spots in the cell, either to a membrane on an organelle, to the outer membrane, or to places where reactions happen. And this wasn't always appreciated. A lot of people thought that the cell was kind of a protein soup, in fact, that cells just diffused kind of randomly throughout this bag. But as we've been able to track proteins, we do see they go to specific spots. So maybe four decades ago, people started to think about how do proteins get to where they should be. And we debated whether this was a big mystery anymore because there has been a lot of insight and even a Nobel Prize.
Right. And that had to do, I guess, with sort of signaling, guiding proteins to these organelles.
Yeah. You mentioned Gunter Blobel in your introduction. And his insight with colleague David Sabatini was that proteins within their amino acid code included kind of a position or sorting signal. And those directed proteins through a variety of mechanisms to particular membranes in a mitochondria or endoplasmic reticulum, the various organelles of the cell. And, people hadn't really considered this, but they went ahead and proved it. And I think in 1999, he won the Nobel Prize for that. But we've realized that that's not the only way cells get proteins to the right place.
And what are some of those other ways?
Well, the one we explored in the mystery quite a bit was messenger RNA localization. And to make a protein, you start with a gene that then makes a messenger RNA strand, and then that is turned into a protein. But what the cell apparently does is it doesn't wait to make the protein to localize it. It moves the messenger RNA to wherever the protein is needed. And there's some reasons that could be an advantage. Efficiency, you move one messenger RNA and it can make many proteins, so you don't have to move many proteins. And you also prevent unneeded protein interactions or even dangerous ones. And so a few people started looking into messenger RNA localization and found it. The rest of the cell biology community kind of thought it was a bit of an oddity or not something that was very widespread. But in the last 4 or 5 years, groups have shown that many proteins are localized this way. Or I think one study in fruit flies showed that 70% of the messenger RNAs went to specific spots in a cell.
Okay, so cell size control, protein localization, what are the other big mysteries that you're covering in this article?
Well, some of the other ones may not be as well known or may not be things people thought of. We've looked at the controversy over lipid rafts, which are this idea that the cell's membrane is organized so that various lipid molecules kind of coalesce proteins in one spot. And this has been a very popular theory. I think several thousand papers written about it. But there still isn't strong evidence, or at least proof, that these lipid rafts exist. And so we explore that debate.
That would be pretty big, a non-existent concept that spawned 3,000 papers.
Well, even the people who think they don't exist have argued that the concept has actually helped the field. And so, you know, this may be one of those areas where it's not wasted effort, but it may have sent you in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. And what else?
Well, the other two we look at is autophagy, which is this process by which the cell kind of cannibalizes itself. It forms a membrane that then eats part of itself when it's starving. It kind of recycles material. And there's been a question on where that membrane comes, essentially how does the cell form a mouth?
Mm-hmm.
And then the fifth one is what we call the nuclear structure. Kind of like the cell, the nucleus in the cell, people looked at as a bag of genes. And we're learning that the nucleus has a very important structure. Where a gene is in the nucleus can affect how active the gene is and various other aspects. And so this kind of nuclear cell biology is another, I think, decade of research that should be fruitful.
All right, John Travis, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Stuart.
John Travis edits a News Focus package in this week's issue on the mysteries of the cell. You can find it, along with other items of cell biology interest, at www.sciencemag.org/special/cellbio2011, where you can also join an online discussion on the article, or tweet your own thoughts on cell biology's mysteries using the Twitter hashtag cellmysteries. The prospect of repairing neural circuits in the brain with transplanted neurons has long stoked the interest and imagination of the research community. But it's a fiendishly complex problem, requiring the insertion of new neurons and their subsequent differentiation and wiring into the brain's existing structure. Now, a team led by scientists at the Harvard Medical School report what they call a proof of concept of this complicated approach. In a study using a mutant mouse strain lacking receptors for the metabolic hormone leptin, the team successfully transplanted immature neurons from normal mice into the hypothalamus of the mutant mice, tracked the transplanted neurons as they differentiated and formed synaptic connections, and showed that the procedure at least partly stemmed the metabolic defects of the mutant mice. While clearly not a practical therapy for obesity or other metabolic syndromes, the finding in mice does offer evidence that neural rewiring might someday emerge as a treatment option for some complex and otherwise intractable neural and neurodegenerative diseases. Corresponding author Jeffrey Maclis talked with me about the study.
The main direction of this work is actually quite broad, and was formulated as a proof of concept for the idea of precise cellular circuitry repair in the mammalian brain and spinal cord. But we actually took a much more directed and specific approach to test that broader idea. What we did was take genetically diseased mice who have a mutation that makes their neurons, their nerve cells in the hypothalamus, deep portion of the brain that controls obesity and eating and energy balance, as it's called in the field, and they have a genetic mutation that makes them unable to respond to a signal in the body called leptin. And what we asked is whether, if we took exactly the right four types of neurons that are known to control that obesity and eating and energy balance, and transplanted them into the diseased brain, could they not only take up positions and survive, as has been shown and known in the field for a number of years, but can they actually build and rewire into the circuitry and do that molecularly, anatomically, and most importantly, electrophysiologically, and then with behavioral function?
So in this case, you were looking at obesity because it was a good example of this kind of complicated sort of multi-level problem? Or?
Exactly right. We chose this problem not because for even a moment we would pursue the idea of neuron transplantation for treatment of obesity. That would never have crossed our mind.
Mm-hmm.
What we did was take this very complicated circuitry in the hypothalamus that has a very clear, measurable outcome, not only obesity in the mice, but changes in their serum glucose, like diabetic human beings have, changes in their insulin level, changes in their fat versus lean body weight. So we had a number of measures that we could carefully analyze,
mm-hmm.
and we used that complex circuitry as a test case for whether precisely selected and controlled neuron transplants could really rewire the brain, not just make a chemical, not just bathe the brain in a neurotransmitter, but actually join the circuitry at the microscopic level in a functional way.
So let's dig a bit deeper into the actual work. You chose obesity as sort of a model problem. How did you actually go investigating this in these mice?
Well, first, we wanted to find out when the four kinds of neurons that are known to function centrally in this circuitry are developed initially during development of the embryo. So we went back into mouse development and found exactly the time when these neurons are being formed from progenitors, or what some might term stem cells. And then we took those very young neurons at the time that they are just deciding who they're going to be, and under a very high-resolution ultrasound microscope, essentially a more sophisticated version of the obstetrical ultrasound that is used to monitor pregnancies on an ongoing basis throughout the population. We took a very fancy version of that ultrasound and placed tiny, tiny microscopic amounts of fluid containing these four correct kinds of neurons into the right position in the hypothalamus,
mm-hmm.
where they would normally function in this circuitry. But remember, in the mice we transplanted them into, the neurons in that circuitry have a mutation, and they don't have the receptor
mm-hmm.
for this molecule leptin. So they're diseased and not functional.
And so you were taking essentially the functional equivalent of those non-functional neurons, putting them in the right places, and then seeing if they would wire correctly in the mouse brain.
Exactly right. And in a sense, these new neurons have the right antennas to listen to leptin, the signal that's released by fat and tells an animal or a human to use energy in a certain way and not to gain weight. And these replacement part neurons have the antennas to listen to that, and then the four types of neurons wire into the circuitry and turn some systems on, turn some systems off, and do that with a very precise electrophysiological code at the so-called neuronal synapses.
And you found actually that this did behave in that fashion, that these new neurons were able to sort of integrate into the system.
Yes, the way we did that was to use cells from mice that are literally green glowing under ultraviolet light. They have a jellyfish fluorescent mm-hmm. green protein built into them, so all of their cells glow just like a rock poster would under ultraviolet fluorescent kind of light. And we could take those cells, separate them apart, and after transplantation, identify the donor neurons by this green fluorescence, and then analyze using a number of molecular and microscopic modes of analysis to see that they developed into the four right kinds of neurons. And then we could actually go into those areas of the brain with special recording electrodes that could record the recipient's neurons and the recipient mouse's brain system
mm-hmm.
and the donor neurons one by one. And what we found is that these neurons not only turned into the right kinds of cells, but sent signals to the recipient's brain and received signals from the recipient's brain. And then we were able to use electron microscopes to see that these synapses looked correct. And ultimately, we weighed the mice, we followed their insulin and glucose and fat levels, and saw them not turn into morbidly obese mice as all of their brothers and sisters did.
So the neurons were in the right place and sort of firing in the right ways and receiving the right signals, and that had this actual effect on the phenotype.
That's correct.
Well, that seems, you know, obviously like a pretty remarkable result. And I think, as you stressed, this is not this is not something that would ever be a practical treatment for obesity. You know, you referred to the work as a proof of concept. I'm curious about your own views of its larger significance, if we could sort of wrap up with that.
Sure. Well, after about 100 years of rigid dogma that no new neurons ever entered the adult mammalian central nervous system, the brain, the spinal cord, first with some tantalizing but not well accepted evidence in the 1960s, and then with building evidence since the middle of the 1990s, it's been clear that small neurons are added to two systems, even in adults, from mouse to monkey to man. And those are in an evolutionarily old area working on smell called the olfactory bulb, and in a small region of the hippocampus called the dentate gyrus. And elegant work from multiple investigators, including my own lab, have shown that new neurons can wire into those two systems and function. But many people have thought that those very old evolutionary systems might somehow be very special cases, and that there's something quirky about those small little neurons that go into those systems that wouldn't ever generalize. Now that there's very powerful developmental biology and stem cell biology by which we can think that we might be able to guide the very precise development of neuron types that might be useful in ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease or spinal cord injury or Parkinson's disease or Huntington's disease, among others. It's not at all clear in the field whether such neurons, even if they were perfectly made, could actually build into circuitry, rewire, and function. And these experiments that we did are a proof of principle that in those more what some of us call point-to-point systems, going from one place to a long, faraway, distant place in the nervous system, that neurons could actually rewire and function. And that leads to a lot of motivation to take the biology to be able to build exactly the kinds of neurons, either for transplantation in those disorders or in a somewhat futuristic approach, but that we and others have actually brought to success in mice, the recruitment of new neurons from progenitors or stem cells that are already in the brain. So that idea is the idea of activating the rewiring and the repair of the brain from within, but not just in some random way, but with very precise control of what kind of neurons we want. So this work says, if we can do that, there's reason to believe that we could repair circuitry responsible for motor function, for sensory function, and for other behaviors.
Jeffrey Maclis, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
Jeffrey Maclis is a corresponding author on a new proof-of-principle study of brain circuit repair using transplanted neurons.
Our usual Science Now segment, featuring stories from our online daily news site, is taking a break for Thanksgiving and will be back with us next week. And that concludes the November 25th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.